Hello and welcome to I Am the Egg Pod with me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, it's a welcome return to dramatist, author and playwright Dan Rebelato. Hello.
Hi, Chris.
How are you?
I'm good. How's your pandemic been?
Oh, it's good that it's being so well handled.
Exactly, the gift that keeps on giving.
So, the album you're talking about today, there's a bit of history with this one, because we have actually talked about it before on the podcast. A while back, with Beardy Man, it's McCartney 2. And shortly after that was uploaded, you contacted me, and I had a feeling things weren't right, because you referred to him as Mr. Beardy Man. So, you want to do a re-evaluation of this? Tell me why, first of all.
Well, I think because in the podcast that you do with Beardy Man, I think McCartney 2 does get a bit of a kicking. And I really love this album, and I thought it would be appropriate to give it a slightly jauntier stroll through Pepperland than you afforded it the first time, in the way of a kind of a rebuttal or a defence or something like that, because I think there are lots of really odd things about this record. It's a very easy record to dislike. But actually, I think there are so many wonderful things about it. And some of the reasons why it's easy to dislike are actually the reasons why I love it.
Mm. And I've recorded a warning for you, which I'm going to play for you now.
Oh, Dan Rebelato, retract those claws. Just because Beardy Man's opinion differs to yours. Dan Rebelato, retract those claws. What you adore, he abhors. Soft paws, retract those claws. Let's make love, let's not make wars. Soft paws, retract those claws. I think Beardy Man's a dorps.
I've never had my own jingle. That is fantastic. I can't believe you did that. No, Chris, look, I everyone is entitled to their own opinion, however yes. risible or perverse that opinion might be. So I'm not going to criticize Beardy Man at all.
Good. So, let's have a brief bit of history. So let's go back to spring 79, and it's just following the release of Back to the Egg, which we did before as well, didn't we? And
we did.
Paul held a press conference to promote that in Abbey Road, with naturally the studio being decorated to look like a giant frying pan. And it was here he mentioned, because the press were there, and he announced plans for a Wings tour. And then summer 79, July 79, Paul hired a 16-track studio recording studio. No mixing desk, straight in, and he spent 6 weeks in his studios in Pease Marsh, as well as the Spirit at Renacan studio in Campbelltown, basically recording songs that were, he said, intended to play at parties. And he recorded a number of these, often improvised in the same sort of carefree way he'd done McCartney 10 years earlier. Then we moved to 16th of January 1980, and the Wings tour of Japan commenced. And Paul, Linda, their kids, and Lawrence Juber, 14-hour flight, they landed. Customs found 219 grams of grass in his bag. And Paul basically spent 10 days as prisoner 22, Metropolitan Jail. While he was locked up, he was reflecting and he was thinking about the future of Wings. And he decided, no, I'm gonna finish those demos off and release them as Mark McCartney 2, originally intended as a double album. But McCartney 2 was released on the 16th of May, 1980.
I think what that story, the way that this record fits into that story is a little bit that it feels to me, and of course I'm completely projecting, I don't know what his actual mentality was, but it feels a bit like that with Back to the Egg, even though, as you know, I think it's a really good record. He comes to a bit of a halt with Wings. You know, he wanted to get a band together. He wanted to do the touring again. He wanted to be as successful as the Beatles, and kind of Wings in the late 70s are as successful as the Beatles. And then it feels like he's kind of like, well, but where do I go next? And I feel a bit like, you know, there's that story, which I always love, where John Lennon, I think, said that he started playing, writing songs on the piano because he got bored of the shapes his fingers made on the guitar.
Mm.
And it feels to me like Paul is, in 1979, is thinking, I'm just doing more of me. I've done all the kind of versions of the big rock band thing. I've done the yacht rock album, the stadium rock album, and so on. And I really need something that's going to force me to write in a different way. And so he, as you say, he holes up in his studio. And the other thing, of course, is that he hires a load of synthesizers, or buys, I don't know what however he gets them. And so he's got a load of this new, very new music technology. And as you say, he fools around with it, he improvises with it, and he lets that technology change how he writes songs, I think.
Oh, certainly, yeah. There's an interesting thing. I mean, we'll talk about it later, but the order that they were recorded in primarily started off just with instrumentals noodling away. It's interesting for me, it's him at home. You're in the studio with Paul. It's,
yeah.
You know, you hear all these Beatles box sets coming out, and we love hearing the chat. And this is Paul on his own. He's not going to be chatting to anybody. He's just making music.
Yeah, that's right. And also, you mentioned that it was originally conceived as a double album, or at least it was initially assembled as a double album. And my story with this record is that I bought McCartney to, I think, probably around 85, something like that, and I didn't like it very much. I had a very kind of Beardy Man view of the record. I loved Coming Up, and then it, to me, it's sort of diminishing returns after that. But then about 20, 25 years ago, a friend of mine burnt me a copy of the bootleg The Great Lost McCartney album, which is, I think, is that initial assembly of the two album version. And it made much more sense to me. And I suddenly started to fall in love with it because, I mean, first of all, Coming Up is the last song on that rather than the first. And the first side, I mean, you've got to, it was a CD, so you've got to imagine what the sides of the vinyl were. But the whole first side is kind of electronic stuff. And yeah. So it actually prepares you in a completely different way for what the project is. And I sort of found this stuff really sort of mysterious and quite beguiling. And so by the time you start getting to the more recognisably McCartney things, they're now, I'm hearing them in the context of this much more experimental, slightly trancey, slightly techno-y kind of vibe he's got going in the studio. And I kind of heard them in a more interested way as well. So it's really that original bootleg that sent me back to McCartney 2 and made me realise that there's something much more interesting going on here.
So should we start with track one?
And
sure. It was the final song to be recorded, released as a single on the 11th of April 1980, 3 days later in the US. And in America, they flipped the B-sides, which was a Wings live performance at the Apollo in Glasgow, and it hit number one. It's Coming Up.
Well, of course, I just adore this. I mean, it's just wonderful, isn't it? There's nothing to dislike about it. It's that brilliant thing of Paul kind of just going, you know, I've done these things that are quite challenging and that, you know, durational and got very strange chord sequences. And now I'm just going to create something that is so catchy that no one can catch it. You know what I mean? It's just so ridiculously catchy. It kind of, you know, in a funny way, it reminds me a bit of whatever gets you through the night. It's got that same sort of sense of casting off any sort of attempt to be a completely serious artiste and just going, and now let's do disco-y pop in the most sort of life-enhancing way you possibly can. So I think this is just gorgeous. Absolutely gorgeous. What about you?
Yeah, absolutely. We talked about it before, Back to the Egg, and you're not keen on things like Rockestra.
No.
What I think about Rockestra, what I love about that is you think before that he'd been doing London Town and been getting criticised for doing silly love songs and these sort of seen to be lightweight. But then he wants to do Rockestra, so he just calls on, you know, members of Led Zeppelin. And yeah, we'll come along. You know, it's that breezy way of doing it. And he could have carried on that way. He could have got anybody at that particular time. But he chose to do this and release it as a single.
Yeah.
And it's just so breezy.
It is. And then, of course, in the video, he creates his own sort of popestra, you know, by playing all the different sort of pop stars. And it's a great... actually, that's one of my first sort of memories of... Oh, no, I remember Mull of Kintyre. But I remember seeing this video on TV a lot and thinking it was kind of amazing. It's great. What do you think about this compared to the live version?
Oh, this is 100 times better for me.
Yeah, I agree.
This is the one Lennon heard. John heard it.
That's right,
and,
yeah.
And Paul says, you know, it inspired him to... You know, it's between them, but Paul said that was one of the reasons that inspired it. But I was looking at the dates. John... He said himself he thought it was brilliant, but it was after this point he recorded I Don't Want to Face It. And if you think that guitar in that,
yes, bum, 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 yes,
I'm wondering if that was a little, could have been a little nod.
Oh, that is very interesting.
Okay, let's go. Ein, zwei, hickle, pickle.
What do you think of the live version then?
I like it. You know, it's the thing I always think is because, of course, that was December, wasn't it? December 79.
Yeah.
So it hadn't come out yet. It hadn't been a single. But surely everybody in that venue must have just thought that is an instant classic. You know, I mean, this is such a utterly infectious, joyful song. So you get a kind of... You get a response in that live recording, which is almost as if, you know, almost like he's playing Got to Get You Into My Life or something. It's so immediate. It's so completely joyful. So, yeah, I like it. It's quite a rough recording. I think that's one of the things. I'd love to have heard a good recording of a Wings rehearsal of it. That might have been quite a fun thing to hear. But actually, no, I like the sort of chipmunky, you know, very speeded vocals and the kind of cleanness. It's a funny thing I find with the those absolute solo McCartney things where it's just him in the studio. Just occasionally, it feels a little because it's all him, and so of course it's got all of his rhythms. Sometimes it feels a little bit too clean, in a way that, you know, that if you've got a group of people in a band, they don't perfectly mesh, and so you get a bit of texture in there. But actually, with the more electronic stuff, actually the cleanliness and neatness, I think, is one of its most appealing features. So, yeah, I love that.
I think it's nice that you've got them together because you can hear the difference between Wings and solo Paul. And the Wings version, to me, is a very staid performance. It's you know, any band in the world could be performing that, but his is on his own, all that imagination and the little saxophone solos and it's just Beatle level imagination, all the stuff that's going on in there.
And it's funny, isn't it, because the live version, I think it's quite late in the gig and his voice is quite hoarse, so it's actually it kind of turns it a little bit into a bit more of a kind of rock song, whereas on the album, it's so utterly pure pop. It's almost a sort of parody pure pop. You know, and so actually I find the difference between them. He's also doing that sort of slightly bluesy voice as well on some of his phrasing in the live version.
Yeah.
Which is sort of, and it's an interesting thing because Paul McCartney's relationship to sort of authenticity is interesting, I think, in the way that, you know, John Lennon, I think, you sort of think of him as being, he's about, particularly in the 70s, he's about authenticity. He's speaking from the heart. He's talking about real things. Whereas Paul sometimes talks about real things and then sometimes there's a sort of confection to them. So, and I think you get that kind of ambiguity in his attitude to the world in the live version and the album version.
Mm. B-side as well on this, the second B-side, Lunchbox Odd Socks, which was recorded by Wings in 75 during Venus and Mars.
Yes, it is what it is. It's not one of the ones that really excites me particularly. I'm not quite sure why he sticks this on here sort of 5 years later. It's a strange choice, isn't it? There are so many other interesting B-sides at this in the wave of singles that comes out that come out of this album as well.
And then we move to the second track. It's Paul experimenting with an analog ARP sequencer, later released as a limited edition 12-inch single on the 15th September 1980, Temporary Secretary.
Oh, man, this is just great. Oh, I think this is so fantastic. I love the fact he started playing it live. You know, it's from about 2015. He just started, and that, I mean, I haven't seen him live for ages, but it must have been extraordinary to have that weird, really techno-y sequencer thing kicking off, and then he's playing the song, and it looks, from YouTube clips, it looks fantastic in concert as well.
Yes,
yeah. I love it. I do think it genuinely sounds like techno. I need a temporary. One of the things I do think about this record and why, as another reason why I think I didn't like it in the mid-80s and I came to like it more 15 years later, is that the technology that he used, which was in 1979, completely, absolutely the latest stuff, it becomes ubiquitous in the very early 80s. I was looking at, in fact, I'm working with, on a complete different project, I'm working with two theatre sound designers who are wonderful, brilliant music technology nerds who identified all the equipment for me. And they pointed out that he's using a Roland CR78 CompuRhythm drum machine, which, as soon as you look that up, you realise that it's all over music from about 79 to about 83, 84. It's Tainted Love, Mad World, Fade to Grey, Heart of Glass, Enola Gay, Vienna, In the Air Tonight, I Can't Go for That. These are all using the same thing. But what that means is, about the time I heard McCartney 2, I think the world has moved over to the kind of the Roland 808 drum machine, which is much punchier, much more acoustic sounding. And suddenly, the kind of technology of 79 sounds a little bit tinny, because I think that this is a bit one of those type drum machines, and so of course it felt a bit sort of weak and sort of flabby and cheap and plasticky to me in 85. By 2000, everyone's fallen in love with those sounds again. So suddenly you're getting kind of Radiohead and Underworld and Fatboy Slim are all kind of looking for these sort of cheap, or not cheap, but these early synths and these drum sounds. And so suddenly it feels amazing again. And this is a great example of that. Temporary Secretary, which I think in the 80s I just thought was a ridiculous, irritating, painful, stupid song, actually just feels like it. Actually, it's got a thunderous beat to it. That sequencer thing, that thing, is, you know, actually is kind of fascinating. Because the thing I was saying earlier, I will stop in a second. The thing I was saying earlier about Paul trying to kind of reinvent what his songwriting might be, it's sort of like he's, you know, he's the person who wrote, you know, Here, There and Everywhere. It's sumptuous vertical melodies and so on. And he's kind of thinking, okay, well, what if I take apart my songwriting? So there's melody, and then there's rhythm, and then and all of these things are sort of slightly deconstructed. And here you get the kind of the really strange kind of micro rhythm and micro melody of that sequencer thing. And he's basing everything around that. So he can afford to be sort of weirdly monotonous through the song, because at the kind of granular level, the song is doing something so kind of exciting. And it is pointing away to electronic dance music.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, apparently, you know, 15 years ago, suddenly some DJs rediscover it and it's playing it in the clubs and everyone goes crazy for it. Yeah. Because this may be the last time Paul McCartney is genuinely someone you can look at and go, there's a bit of future of music that he spotted there. And I think this is a great example.
And completely by mistake. I mean, he said he was trying to resemble, in his words, a space typewriter. So you can picture him on the keyboard doing exactly that. But that was basically techno.
Yeah.
That was by mistake.
Exactly. And he's doing it by kind of hiding a tune in the rhythm. You see what I mean? There's a sort of weird way he goes, let's just propel this through an incredibly fast, intricate melody that actually becomes a kind of rhythmic pulse right through it. And it also glitches as well. There are sort of interesting bits where it seems to kind of slightly go wrong, which is also fascinating. Mm-hmm. It's also, and then, of course, having said that, then there's the really strange thing that it's acoustic guitars coming on it.
Yes.
Yeah. And I find that a really fascinating clash of textures. I can well imagine people thinking that's a terrible thing to do, but actually that very sort of promiscuous mixing of instruments, A, is something that he has always done, but B, actually feels, again, it's pointing towards the freedom that electronic dance music would have kind of into the 90s. And you're getting it here.
Yeah, I guess because we've got the benefit of hindsight looking at it from sort of Human League Depeche modes backwards, because that was just purely synthesizers. He's maybe thinking things like Because or Here Comes the Sun, where it's, you know, the synth was an addition to the main thing. So,
Exactly. And also, I suppose this is a point. I mean, that, of course, there's been Kraftwerk and Tangerine Dream and various things through the 70s. But it's not as if the rules have been sort of, the genres have been completely defined, that if you're doing electronica, you cannot have acoustic instruments, you know, which I think would later become a bit of a kind of purist DJ thing. He's just kind of mixing those things up. And I love it. And it absolutely worms its way into you, whether you like it or not. And that's why, of course, I'm sure some people really hate it.
And as I said earlier, it was released as a limited edition, only 25,000 copies. And I got one from a charity shop a few years ago.
Oh, wow.
Amazing. With the McCartney interview from 1980, which was released and deleted on the same day. Oh, best day of my life.
Amazing.
Apart from my wedding, obviously.
But, and even then, it's close.
Thank you.
10-minute B-side, Secret Friend.
Man, yeah, Secret Friend. Well, this is another real, for me, this is a real highlight of the this whole recording, weird recording 6 weeks that he spent. It's kind of, I mean, if the A side is sort of techno, then the B side is kind of trancey. It feels like it's got a bit of Tropicália, bit of trance, and that sort of that really kind of strange, haunting line, "Feel like you've never felt before once more," which feels like just the kind of thing that in 1989 people would have been raving to. Yes, yeah. Do you know what I mean? And it's got another one of those sort of microrhythmic sequencer patterns. So you can see why he kind of thought that was a good pairing. But I think also what, going back to that John Lennon, you know, the shape of your hands on the guitar, I guess he's also trying to find ways of shaking himself out of the chord sequences that his fingers automatically find. So in both of these songs, he appears to set up his sequencer thing, and then he's just kind of rolling them up on the auto transposer. So Secret Friend does this really odd thing. I think it's just moving one semitone up and down the whole way through the song, which is, I mean, actually, when you really listen to it and notice it, it makes you feel slightly sick because it's got that kind of that kind of slight little lurch, but it gives it eerie, slightly creepy feel, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, on Temporary Secretary, you've got the "She could be a neurosurgeon," that bit where he's again just going up chromatically on the bass line, which is the kind of thing that if he'd composed it on the piano or the guitar, he probably wouldn't do, because it would just feel like a sort of, well, it would feel kind of somehow a bit crass, because you'd on the guitar you'd just be sort of doing a bar chord up the neck. And whereas, you know, when he's sort of just letting this weird sequence auto transpose itself, it becomes a sort of rather fascinating, quite complex thing. So yeah, I think that's fantastic. The drums on Secret Friend sound amazing. Mm-hmm. He's drumming over the drum machine, isn't he? He must have laid down the drum track, and then he's just drumming over the whole thing. And I read an interview where he sort of says it's not as if he could loop his drums. He actually has to.
Yes.
Records the 10-minute song, and then he has to sit there in the studio playing the drums for 10 minutes over the top of it. But there's a wonderful bit where the synthesizer line drops out and the drums kind of thunder out, and I think he's recorded them like in the bathroom or whatever. It's one of those sorts of things where there's a really echoey room, but they sound fantastic. I think it's a bit Animal Collective, I think, this song.
It is lovely. I think what you were saying about that, again, back to Temporary Secretary, going up on that, she kept bringing her own. When it gets to that, Anita! Anita! And it's what dance music does now. You just build it up, have the pause, boom, temporary.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's doing that. But Secret Friend is so discordant that it works. And when it resolves into the final, back to the root notes.
Yes.
Because it is just notes. I'm sure it's one finger, as you say, messing around up and down. And it's really satisfying, even though it is 10 minutes long.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? I mean, I'm quite impatient with music. I love 3-minute pop songs. But this one, I never get bored of this. And there are a couple of really long songs from this general group of recordings that actually I kind of feel like, yeah, if Secret Friend, if they found another 20 minutes of it, I think I'd listen to it. It's also, I think that the lyrics are really strange on this record. He's as experimental in his lyrics on this record. He allows himself to be much more kind of cryptic and sort of slightly fragmentary, and you know, this one, as I say, it's got that you know "feel like you've never felt before once more." There's a thing I only heard a couple of days ago, actually. "Cast adrift on some uncharted sea," he says. It's again got that slightly spacey image, makes me think of wine sailing on a wine dark open sea as well. But you know, there's a lot of really interesting atmospheric stuff going on there. So yeah, I think Secret Friends are amazing. Well, you know.
Then we move to track three, On the Way.
Yeah, this is one of the ones that I don't really get on with particularly. I sort of always forget it's on McCartney 2 because it so stands out. It's so unlike everything else on it. He was watching The Devil's Music, some documentary on BBC One. And I read in the interview, he said, I should do a blues song because that's the sort of music I like. I go, really? Is that really the kind of music Paul McCartney likes? Because, mostly I find him, he's so brilliant at pastiching and trying his hand almost every kind of music. But I find when he does blues, that is less impressive to me or less persuasive. You know, the Steve Miller stuff on Flaming Pies, the stuff I kind of I don't know, this is not, I'd skip through to get to other things. I mean, I think, although having said that, it's, and we'll talk about his voice, I'm sure, through this, but as his voice has got a bit more ragged, actually I think he's a more persuasive bluesy singer. I think Women and Wives on McCartney 3 he sounds a bit like an old bluesman offering general advice. And that the Hunt You Down, Naked, Sea Link on Egypt Station, which gets more and more bluesy, actually I find that quite exciting and quite persuasive. But actually I think this sort of period, it just feels like he's trying out the blues and is not really sort of committing to it. So so this is not really one for me particularly. What do you think of it?
Yeah, same. I think because we're so spoilt, we know he is the king of melody, he can do anything, and it just seems like he clearly enjoys it. It's something that recurs throughout his career. He's having a ball, like you say, all the Steve Miller stuff. He wouldn't put it on. He was probably having the time of his life doing it. But it's like when you see bands and people who do guitar solos, it's great for them, you know, and not that much fun for everybody else. So he's enjoying it, but maybe.
It's quite a good lyric, I think, but the actual arrangement and that very, very spacey echo doesn't encourage me to listen to it. So I never tune into the lyrics. So again, I think there is something quite nice in the lyric, but it doesn't feel like it really works. Not for me.
No. However.
Don't go jumping waterfalls. Please keep to the lake. People who jump waterfalls sometimes can make mistakes. And I need love, I need love, like a second needs an hour, like a raindrop needs a shower. I need love every minute of the day, and it wouldn't be if you ever should decide to go away.
We move to track four, second single from the album, Waterfalls.
Oh man, this is so beautiful, isn't it? And this is so beautiful. It's just really here's one of the things I think that's really interesting about McCartney and why he's actually quite difficult to understand, which is that because I think he fundamentally has a pop sensibility, and of course he's written great rock songs, but he's written great rock songs and also he's written good country songs and he's written great piano ballads, and his pop sensibility is that he will try his hand at lots of different types of music, which I think goes back to the thing I was saying about, whereas someone like Lennon or Dylan, there's a kind of authenticity thing. And I think what that means is that when they do odd records, you can kind of understand them by going, well, I'm going to sort of tuck it into a sense of their authentic personal journey. Whereas I think McCartney, it's really interesting because he's actually quite evasive as a personality, a musical personality. He's quite hard to actually identify. So it's more difficult when you get an odd record like this to understand what it is he thinks he's doing. You know, whereas when Neil Young does an electronic album, even though you might hate it, you kind of go, oh, well, that's Neil Young for you. He's this sort of perverse, sort of screw the man kind of person. The only exception I would say to that is that I don't think of Paul McCartney as a confessional songwriter, except in the sense that I think we also have to look back and go, he has written love songs for over 60 years. And we need to take that seriously and think this is not a sort of affectation or just genre playing. This is someone who seriously has been investigating what the value and meaning of love is in his life and other people's lives for all that time. And this, I think, is completely sincere and totally beautiful. You know, I need love as his chorus. It's just, it's absolutely gorgeous, and it's heartbreaking. And I think his voice is really interesting on this, don't you think?
Yes.
It sounds like his voice from Chaos and Creation. It sounds much thinner and reedier, and I hear it as being genuinely heartbroken at the thought of losing love. So I think this is sublime. I've sometimes moved to tears by it. I find this very, very, very moving. I think when I first heard it, I thought it was sort of a song to Linda, and maybe it is to Linda, but I wonder if it's also a parental love song. It's about it's that thing that, of course, I always knew, but having a kid, you have that thing of that intense vulnerability where you think, you know, if anything happens to you, I'm destroyed. And I feel the song, that's why I forgive the polar bears, which could be very cutesy, but I now hear that as him trying to find a way to talk to his children about, please don't get into danger, because I cannot bear the thought of anything happening to you.
I mean, he said at the time, you know, it's basically saying, don't go doing a lot of dangerous stuff because I need you.
Yeah.
Again, he's saying, and that's the kind of more mature thought for me than I would have had been able to do 20 years prior, because I just didn't realise that it's not going to be here forever. Yeah, he's growing up in front of our ears.
Yes. And have you watched 321, the Rick Rubin documentary? Because there's that nice bit where Rick Rubin puts on Waterfalls and Paul looks slightly embarrassed and says, oh, those synth strings, I don't really like them. And Rick Rubin very confidently kind of goes, oh, no, they sound really, really contemporary. And Paul is kind of, oh, do you think? Oh, yeah, I know. And I think it's really interesting. I think it goes back to that thing of the way that the technology has kind of come round again. And actually, we like hearing that. I think the plastic strings are part of what is beautifully sort of desperate about this song.
I love the vulnerability about this as well, because you think, I don't know, say things like, here today, which we've talked about before, and Andy Miller was on, who did a brilliant talk on that, and he was saying everybody was expecting him to do it, so he had to do it, and he wanted to do it. But in that sense, it was kind of, not contrived, that's the wrong word, but it was a deliberate, right, I'm going to do this, it's going to be emotional. But I think this is purely, I mean, he described it, he just spewed the lyrics out, and he was going to change them, but he just kept them, because that's kind of how he felt. Yeah, his voice is vulnerable. The whole thing, and it sounds like his voice is about to break, as you say.
Yeah.
And he would have been recording this at home. It's not like he was in the studio with George Martin or whatever. He's just on his own, feeling that emotion. It's an amazing piece of music, I think.
And it's interesting, because this is a sort of Wings hangover, isn't it? This is a song that Wings were going to do. And actually, I think it's a really smart decision to not do it in a room with loads of other people with a rock band, and to do it in this very vulnerable, thin, isolated way. I think it's beautiful. Have TLC ever explicitly said, yes, we ripped this song off? I can't find an answer to that. It's weird, isn't it?
It's pretty blatant, isn't it?
It's very blatant. I mean, it's great. I mean, it's a terrific song, but sort of odd not to acknowledge that at all. But maybe they have acknowledged it, and I don't know.
Maybe Paul Weller wrote it.
Hi, George.
Morning, Terry.
Hi, George.
Morning, Terry.
No, 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 no!
Tombstones may break my bones, but names will never hurt me.
Check. Check, 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 check. Mama, check, 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 check. Mama, come on, check, 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 check. Mama,
on the B side of this, as the single, was Check My Machine, which was actually the first song to be recorded during these sessions, literally to check his machine. What do you think of this?
Oh, this is one of my absolute favourites. this is so great. And, you know, it's got that wonderful, loping, quite dubby bass line. It's got his kind of very speed vocal. It's got a real groove. I mean, I think it.
Oh, yes.
It just really seems amazing. And if again on that 3-2-1 documentary, and through most of it, I don't know what you thought, but Paul, through it, seems to be sort. I don't know whether it's an act he's putting on. He's looking like he's quite unconcerned and he's quite casual about all these amazing songs. But when Check My Machine comes on, this big grin comes on his face. A 60s. Paul McCartney grin comes on his face, and you can see he's really pleased with himself, as he should be. This is wonderful. I think this is like Gorillaz or something, don't you think?
Yes, definitely.
It really sounds like you absolutely can play this now and people go, oh yeah, this is a 21st century bit of pop music. So fantastic.
Yeah, and so much fun, and it's got real drama in it. There's that section where it's just the drums and that. It's real drama in this completely crazy piece of music.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yes, and so even though it doesn't progress exactly, but it does feel like it builds up. And there are those breaks where he seems to be saying, there's a lot of echo on it, so it's quite hard to make it out. But he's kind of going, I don't know what's wrong with me and that sort of stuff, and it does feel I think it's amazing. And is it a banjo? It makes me think of, do you remember, was it Swamp Thing by The Grid? It was a
blimey.
I know that's taking you back, but you know, it makes you think of that sort of weird thing when dance music started to go, actually we can pull in any instrumentation, any musical source we like, and here it is on Check My Machine.
And similar with this, when I first heard it, I remember actually buying the single, going up to my bedroom, and it was the old Dansette.
Oh, right.
I'd inherited, put it on, and played the A side, loved it. And it just blew my head off.
Yeah.
But the weird thing was, a couple of weeks later, I was watching telly, and it was Tweety and Sylvester. And I heard the, "Hi, George."
Oh.
"Morning, Terry." And it blew my head off, this song I'd bought a couple of weeks earlier.
Oh,
but
nice.
Yeah.
"Tempered, savage, thick-skinned, dumb.
Sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never hurt me.
Morning, Terry."
"Hi, George."
From Tweet Zoo is the episode, if you want to Google it.
Oh, I will. YouTube, here I come.
Then we move to track 5, "Nobody Knows."
Yeah, this is another one that sits quite oddly on the record, I think. I quite enjoy this, actually. It's got one of the things I find amazing about this is I have to remind myself that this isn't actually a band playing together. It's got that feel, actually, of quite a fun, sloppy band. A bit, that sort of... It's a little bit mid-60s Dylan. It sounds like that thing, when Dylan kind of says, "Okay, everyone, swap instruments." And I don't know what impression that is, but
I don't want to tell you who that sounded like.
But, that sort of sense that and everyone has to play an instrument they don't really know how to play. And it's got that kind of shambling blonde on blondie kind of feel to it. So... I quite like it. It's nice and loose. It feels like the band's responding to each other. The lyrics feel a bit placeholdery, I think. But, it's all right. What do you think?
Yeah, it's him messing around in the studio, isn't it? But I love the fact... All of the ones that are on this album, he chose. So he could have picked anything. And it's just amusing to something, what he left off and what he kept on.
Yeah.
And like you were saying about Check My Machine with that huge smile on his face... This obviously meant something to him. You don't know what might have been happening when he was recording it. It might have been a memory or something. Yeah, it is what it is.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly, yeah. It's fine, but I never remember it's there.
Track 6, "Front Parlour."
So this is another very early one he recorded, and he's kind of trying out the synthesizers on this. Mm. And I've got to say, I really like this. I find this, it's very simple, but it's I find it very insistent and actually very melodic. It's got that thing because you can place the instruments. It could be a theme tune for a children's science program of the 70s.
Yes.
But I find that ghostly little central line, the sort of flute synth thing, it stretches the tune out rather beautifully. It's also got lots of those kind of really interesting little crescendos in it. It's what you were saying before about how dance music always does this sort of thing, where it'll kind of break it down and then it just builds up the tension. I think the whole thing is kind of in E, And then it does this sort of bridge, I don't know what exactly you'd call it, where it changes key to G, and then it sort of noodles around on the G, and we've got a kind of G6, G7th, back to G6. Then it lurches up to A, and it noodles around there in the 6th and 7th, and then it gets to B. And all the time, you're kind of, it's seeming more urgent, and there's a kind of rising bass line. And of course, by the time he's got to the B, that means he can resolve it very easily by going straight back to the E, which means that it's actually got this incredible sense of drama and tension and beautiful moments of resolution. So, I think this is terrific. I really, really love this. And on the Lost McCartney album bootleg that I had, this is the first song. And how ballsy would it have been to release a new Paul McCartney album and this is your lead-off track?
Oh, that's it, yeah.
That's amazing.
Well, it was the first song, technically it was the first song to be recorded for the album.
Right.
Because he did Check My Machine to Check His Machine. And then he did this. And again, it's him experimenting because he used the kitchen as an echo chamber.
Right.
So he was playing around. So I think it's sort of like him testing stuff out. But whereas most people, you would literally, testing 1, 2, 3. Oh, just make a song.
That's right. That's right. And there's something interesting. I can't, because I don't know enough about electronic music. But the bass, it sounds almost like there's a sort of vocoder thing happening in the bass. But I think there's probably just some playing with waveform. But the bass seems to be kind of doing this thing that I can't quite make out. But it's, I think it's lovely. I think this is a very beautiful bit of music.
Someone sleeping through a bad dream. Tomorrow it will be over, for the world will soon be waking to a summer's day.
Next summer's day song.
Yeah, I like this. If I remember rightly, on the bootleg, this is the first time you get a kind of ballad. So actually, this comes out of all of the electronic stuff. Actually, I think possibly it didn't have lyrics in the bootleg version. So I don't have any more, I can't remember.
It doesn't.
And so actually, it sounds more like Brian Eno, because you've got this sort of harmonium or something. It's like music for airports or Evensong on Evening Star. So it feels like it's actually part of a more ambient thing. I like the fact he's got the lyrics on there, and I quite like them. I think they're very mysterious. It's quite like a hymn, and I like it. I like it a lot. I think it's reminds me a bit of Love Awake, actually, off Back to the Egg that we talked about. It's got that waking up kind of reference as well, and it's the Mellotron, isn't it, from Strawberry Fields?
Yes,
is that right?
Same setting.
How did he have that, or did he just have another Mellotron and use the same setting?
No, that is the Mellotron. It reminds me of the way there's a great couple of photos with the Sgt. Pepper drum skin where they've if you've seen the outtakes of the Sgt. Pepper cover with a different drum skin, and then they replaced it with the one that we know and love.
Right.
Basically, Paul ended up with a crappy one they didn't use, and John, he ended up with the proper one that we know and love. And I love stuff like that. But he ended up with it. I think over the years, a lot of stuff has ended back in the McCartney hands, which is good. Which we're benefiting from the new book, I guess, because I'm sure a lot of those lyrics would have been bought at auction as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting how the Mellotron, even though it's I don't know, 60s, maybe even earlier instrument, it fits into this era quite well. In fact, I think Kraftwerk, maybe they don't use a Mellotron, they use something, I can't remember, it's called something like an orchestron or something like that. It's a similar sort of instrument where they're kind of calling up analog samples or something. And it feels, I think it's got a kind of mesmeric, shimmering haze feel to it. I think this is very lovely. It's like a pump organ sound to it as well. Yeah.
And an early sign, it's quite a sort of classical piece of music, really. It's eventually completely embrace it. So this is the first kind of clue as to what's going on in his mind.
Yeah, I suppose that's right, isn't it? And particularly because it started as an instrumental. Yeah, I think this is a lovely moment. On the actual McCartney 2 thing, there's a moment where it starts to... You can breathe a bit and you get a little hint of the pastoral in amongst the kind of urban electronica, even though he was out in the countryside doing this stuff. But yeah, I really like it.
Frozen Jap.
I don't mind this. I think it's all right. This is probably such an irrelevant thing, but I have a slight problem with the kind of Jap bit of it. I mean, actually, I think the title is a bit crass, but also, you know, actually, again, when we talked about Back to the Egg, Old Siam, Sir, and that slightly kind of Orientalism of it, and I sort of think there might be something a little bit lazy, but I quite like the syncopation of it. It feels like once you've heard Front Parlour, there's not necessarily much more you're going to get out of Frozen Jap. It reminds me of Kraftwerk a bit more than other things on it. Computer Love, it's got some of the same kind of sounds. And isn't it called Frozen Japanese in Japan? Maybe that's why they arrested him at the airport. I hear on your next album, Mr. McCartney. Yeah. The drums also sound good on this, I think. This is another in a big echoey room. So actually, I think this is a good headphones song. And as I said, those slightly glassy synth lines, I think, are quite interesting. It's all right. It's all right. It's not something I think the chord sequence is also a little bit more ordinary, isn't it? Sort of F, D minor, C. It's sort of standard kind of moves, whereas I quite like it when he's just kind of almost randomly, okay, let's see what happens. We just go here and have all those kind of sequences just transpose. I think that's quite exciting.
Inspired by Raymond Briggs, Bogey Music.
Yeah, this is a throwaway. It's not a bad idea to write some songs for a film of Fungus the Bogeyman. And I think Paul's a great choice to do that. It's a bit odd to just put one of those songs on the record without explanation, because it just...
there's no context.
Yeah, there's no context at all. You go, Bogey Music? Really? That's what we're doing? I sort of think if you just changed the title and that word in the song, it would have just come across as it is, as a sort of Elvis-y pastiche, and I don't think anybody would have worried about it particularly. There's a really weird thing, though, that it's got a very, very loud delay echo on it. The echo is slightly different from the vocal it's echoing, and I don't quite know how that works. If he did two, if there's a way you can do this, that he did two vocal takes and he's used the echo of one vocal take and the main vocal of another. It's not very interesting addition to the song, but yeah, it's all right. It's kind of nothing, really. I prefer Bogey Wobble.
Do you?
Yeah, I quite like that.
I've got a soft spot for bogey music.
Okay. Oh,
I'm
good.
I'm not keen on Bogey Wobble, though. Tell me what you like about Bogey Wobble.
What do I like about it? I quite like that he's got that sort of oscilloscope what thing, and then all of those what sound to me very Giorgio Moroder, epic, dreamy synth lines comes out. In fact, it makes me think of Electric Dreams, you know, that the Giorgio Moroder Phil Oakey single. It's got a little bit of those kind of things to
Electric
it.
Dreams.
Yeah, I like it. I don't massively adore either of them particularly, but you like bogey music. Well, that's good. I'm pleased to hear that.
I do. I love the way everything's bogey. It's all like the Wombles.
Yeah. You
know, we're wombling this and wombling that, or smurfing. You know, this kind of thing. But Paul was saying he really enjoyed it. And said they live beneath the ground and come out at night and frighten people. And they like everything that is opposite to what we like. If we like warm, dry clothes, they like wet, slimy ones. And they've got all sorts of crazy books in their library, like Lady Chatterley's Bogey. And it just seems like a really bizarre... He just likes it, so he's going to do it.
Yeah.
And then he put it on an album. I think, fair play.
Yeah, fair play. Why not?
Then we come to Dark Room.
Yeah, I really like this. It's quite eerie. Actually, I think this is like a better Frozen Jap. I think it's got a lot of similarities to it. It's slightly mantra-like. It's almost like on one chord, and it's just sort of curling around the root note. It's also, I mean, who knows what it actually means, but I always think of it as being one of the kind of horny Paul songs. You know, like Fuck You and Eat at Home and, you know, and actually Temporary Secretary, even though he's in character in that song. That sort of... I'm sure I saw an interview a couple of days ago that he said that all of his songs are inspired by eroticism or something like that.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Well, this is one of them. And I think, you know, Come Along With Me to My Dark Room, I think is a very, I think it's a good, it's a very simple lyric and repeated, of course. But, you know, I think he extracts a lot of what is sort of quite eerie, slightly menacing, slightly mysterious about it. It's got some affinities with Check My Machine as well, I think. Kind of very slightly reggae light feel to it, similar kind of rhythm, but yeah, I like it. It's sort of, again, in the fuller version, when actually the album is dominated by the electronic songs, something like this, it just feels like it adds another interesting texture to the whole thing. Whereas I feel a bit on McCartney 2, it stands out, or it's supposed to do a bit more work on its own than it's actually meant to do, if you see what I mean.
Yes, definitely. I love it. I think it's great. It's got such a groove
to
it. And again, Beardy Man, who was on before, he was saying, you know, about the way he's got the drums going double speed and half speed at the same time. He's inadvertently inventing drum and bass.
Drum and bass, yes, right. Yeah.
You know, it's,
Yeah, it's really good. And it's also because, you know, the thing that McCartney always does is he makes very, very complicated things seem very simple. And so actually, that's why I think this album really repays listening, you know, and re-listening, because actually you get into the layers and textures of something like Dark Room, and it's doing something really complicated and fascinating. Yeah, I love that one.
One of these days, when my feet are on the ground, I'm gonna look around and see what's right, see what's there. Fresh air ever after.
So the album ends with One of These Days.
Oh, this is really beautiful, isn't it? I mean, this is a classic McCartney acoustic guitar ballad. The lyrics are really good. And this is one of those ones where he absolutely nails the feeling. There is not a lot of placeholder stuff that he's left in because it's a bit random. Yeah, I think this is excellent. That pastoral feel to it. It feels like at the end of the album, once again, he's sort of shaking off the digital urbanism of his kind of computer-generated stuff. The harmonies on it are really lovely. The moment, see what's right. And I think it's all him harmonising. Three-part harmony with himself. Just sounds heavenly. It's also the double tracking, because he's double tracked himself, but he hasn't done it too perfectly. So it's got a nice, there's a bit of rawness to it as well. It doesn't sound too sweet. It's lovely. There's no bass on it either, is there? I don't think there's any bass.
No.
So it's, again, it's got a kind of lightness to it. It's not trying to sort of groove. It's just, yeah, oh, it's beautiful. What about you? What do you think?
Oh, yeah. I love his story again. He was saying, in his words, a Hare Krishna bloke came round to see me. He was a nice fellow, very sort of gentle. After he left, I went to the studio and the vibe carried through a bit and I started writing something a bit more gentle that particular day. And it's, again, because Youth was on before and he was saying the same sort of thing about just get a random idea, it could be anything. Once Paul's hooked into that, off he goes. And it's okay, you can say that, you know, if you do like a jam song, something like Dark Room or whatever, he gets the thing going in his head. But this literally a conversation with Hare Krishna. Right, okay. And he creates a song, a beautiful piece of music. It's not just a jam or something.
Yeah, and I do think, you know, I mean, having talked to you about Back to the Egg, I do think Back to the Egg, McCartney 2, Tug of War, I mean, that is a run of work that, you know, is... there was a point when people kind of thought, oh, there was a real dip in the late 70s, early 80s that is recovered by Tug of War, but I think he's on an absolute roll. And there's so many great songs he's writing at this time. And actually, the confidence he's got with the lyric of this song, to write as simply as he does, and yet to make it feel as grand somehow, without it seeming at all pompous, you know, or sententious. It just feels exactly as you describe him saying, you know, there was a nice guy, he seemed very gentle and serene, and I was in that mood of gentle and serene. So, you know, just sort of put a few words together and you know, and there he goes. Oh, it's amazing. Amazing.
So, yeah, so Dan, so as we mentioned before, originally it was going to be a double. There were so many songs recording for this, but you've picked a few that weren't used for the album, one of which was one of the biggest singles of all time. But tell me about these. Let's start with Wonderful Christmas Time.
This is, for me, this is a bit like McCartney 2. I didn't like it when I was in the mid-80s. I thought it sounded very cheap and plasticky compared to, you know, all of those other great 70s Christmas singles. It sounded, you know, that kind of bang, 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 bang thing. Just, it all sounded a bit cheap and cheesy. Whereas actually I've come round to really liking the feel of that. I like the sort of the very bouncy sort of bass synth, and you know, I mean, it's, you know, it's bloody wonderful Christmas time. You know, it's like it's a great, it's just a really really enjoyable, festive, great pop song.
And he makes a lot of money from that.
Yeah, apparently so. Yeah. Well, quite right. And so he's allowed.
Another one you picked, Mr. H. Atom.
Well, I think this is really, really interesting, and I like it a lot. I mean, I think this is where you see he's wearing his influences on his sleeve. I mean, this is clearly he's really interested in Talking Heads and what they've done.
Oh, yeah.
So I think that's... he's doing something there. I think the drive and the pulse of it. It actually, at the very beginning, every time, it sounds to me very like a song that came out, I think, about a year later, which is Pete Shelley's Homo Sapien, which was, you know, that first single he did after the Buzzcocks, which is this sort of really very daring electronic kind of gay anthem. And it's got, and actually rather similarly, this is a song that is, he's tapping into that really weird thing that electronic music or kind of synthesizer music at this point, because it sounded so inhuman, seemed to be a kind of vehicle for lots of people to kind of to talk about sort of gender fluidity and being bisexual and androgynous, and you know, the way you think of the look of those, the Human League and Depeche Mode and things like that, the way there's a sort of visage, absolutely, and people or Kraftwerk playing with a kind of robotic look to them. And this song, of course, is actually sort of in the lyrics is kind of talking about the arbitrary divisions between genders, which I guess is why I think I'm hearing Linda on this.
Oh, yes.
I think it's the only time you hear Linda on any of this material. And I guess he's, because he likes the thought that in this song you would have a blending of male and female voices. I think he's impersonating David Byrne, actually, when he does that kind of, you know, that slightly neurotic kind of voice.
Yes.
You know, and so I sort of hear that in there. But also there's a sort of, in the way they sing, Mr. H. Atom lives in a flat on, there's a kind of, there's a flat, affectless tone that, you know, you think of New Order's Blue Monday or something. I think there's something really interesting in the way he's spotted what loads of other people go on to spot, that there is something in electronic music that is a way, I'm going to say something so pretentious now, but there's an investigation of the kind of limits of human identity and gender. And so I think, okay, this is not a classic song, but I really respect and admire what he's finding to go with that.
The next one you picked, You Know I'll Get You Baby.
Yeah, this is again, I think, funnily enough, this makes me think of bogey music. It's sort of, it's actually got a slightly rock and roll-y feel to it. But again, I think, I keep thinking when I listen to this that Paul is going, what if melody, my great gift, melody, is not the main thing? what does this all this stuff give me? And I think what it often gives him is an incredible sense of pulse and drive, and a different sort of pulse and drive than a live drummer would. And so I think that, you know, I'll Get You Baby, I think what I like about it is you get this sort of, it's got this kind of remorseless sound to it. And actually the kind of lack of variation in it is kind of a motif, which then is picked up by the lyric, where I think on this album, a lot of the time, he sort of figures out the tune he's playing and that triggers a lot of the lyrics. Mm. The way that Coming Up is presumably called Coming Up because he's come up with a bass line that comes up, literally. And this one, You Know I'll Get You Baby, he can hear that there's something kind of rather driving and predatory about the song. It also, yes. I think, this one makes me think of, do you know Silver Apples? Kind of fantastic, kind of late 60s, early 70s, really early electronic music. And you have to have a real taste for very, very early electronic. But they are fantastic. Oh, Chris, man, Silver Apples, they are fantastic. Just a couple of albums. Oh, okay. But things like songs, there's like Sea Green Serenades or Program or You and I, I can really hear what Paul's doing here is sort of coming out of the feel of those. So, I think there's lots to really enjoy about this song.
All right, now, all you horse riders, come on now, get your horses out. All right, all you horse riders, get your horses out. We're gonna go for a ride. Come on.
So I have to compose myself for this one. Next, you've picked All You Horse Riders.
So look, you know, I told you that a friend of mine burnt me a copy of that the bootleg version, and he also photocopied the liner notes, and even on that, which is, you know, they have got hold of a treasure trove of unreleased McCartney experimentals, finished experimentals. Even on that, they say in the liner notes, I always remember this, they say that this must be the nadir of Paul McCartney's recorded output. And if this hasn't happened already, Chris, this is going to be the point where your listeners go, oh, fuck, because I love this. I think this is so funny. I think this is a genuinely very, very funny recording. Deliberately funny. He's not trying to make a serious song. I think he's, you know, he's doing his, you know, Rocky Raccoon voice. And I think there's the Sergeant Pepper joke. I mean, of the first, the title track, that you can hear people laughing at stuff and you don't know what they can see. There's a sort of... He's describing, or he's leading, a series of horse rider moves, and then doing these ridiculous little synth swirls and things to indicate what they are. But I think that's that's really funny. It also makes me think of like one of those sort of early 60s dance songs where they're calling out the dance steps, like Madison Time. Yes. You know, it's a bit like he's just, okay, all you horse riders. he's making everyone do this. So whenever I hear this, firstly, every time this comes up, and I don't know why it comes up quite often on Shuffle, it makes me smile. I have to say, I love the thought of him in his farmhouse, off his face on some dynamite weed, just into a microphone going, I want to see you all, you know, jumping, easy now. Oh, it's great. I think this is really funny. And I think people don't give him credit for being funny. And people get really cross with Paul. As if, so they kind of go, oh, I hate Obladi Oblada. It's kind of a funny song. Maxwell Silver Hammer is kind of a funny song. He's not trying to write A Day in a Life or Revolution or something. He's sometimes trying to be really funny. And I think this is a genuinely very, very funny voice.
It is.
It's also, if you strip away the vocal, I think the backing track and probably those sort of slightly jokey synth things, I think this is a backing track that Hot Chip would kill for. I think there's a really nice funky little guitar line that he puts into it, and then there's that bit I really like where there's a kind of synth bass thing. I'm not very good at singing that bit, but you know, again, you've got those micro rhythms and micro melodies, and also the other joke I think is that it's a song about horses, but he's represented them through this incredibly artificial technology. So there's a sort of, so he knows that he's doing something that is odd and weird and strange, but yeah, no, I love this. I think this is really, really funny.
I think the key thing about this was he never meant to release it. It was just to play, as you said at the beginning, it was just to play at parties and things. So it would have been for his kids and his and for Linda to laugh at as well.
Yeah, exactly.
But it was only through bootlegs that we got to hear it. And, you know, I feel terrible now, you know, criticising that.
It's yeah. Like
looking at it through his photo album and sort of laughing at it. But,
yeah.
Oh, I feel awful. Thanks, Dan. The last one of the outtakes you picked is the astonishing Blue Sway.
Yeah. Yeah, I really like this. Obviously, there are two versions, aren't there, on the big archive box. And I like them both for different reasons. The fully orchestrated version is really powerful. And there's that really lovely descending bass. Dum-dum-dum-dum-dum-dum. And when that's orchestrated, it's got a power to it, and he's written lyrics or like proper audible lyrics to the orchestrated version. My problem with the orchestrated version is there's a lot of saxophone on it, and I've got a sort of child of the 80s aversion to sax, which is sort of has a I just associate with kind of lazy, we're gonna make this a little bit sexy kind of feel to it. So but then the version that he did himself, I think it risks occasionally sounding a little bit Muzak-y, but actually I think it sort of builds up complexity, and I hear a kind of slightly Tangerine Dream feel to it, a sort of slight stratosphere or something like that, and the rhythms and the layers kind of complicate and they get more intricate and ambient and a bit more blissful. And the bass on it. This is... I hate to keep harking back to our previous podcast we did, but we talked on the Back to the Egg thing about how great his bass playing starts to get again at the end of the 70s, kind of inspired by disco and stuff. But there's some really brilliant, lovely, clever, selective bass stuff that he's doing here. I think this is lovely.
So, Dan, thank you so much, as always. Tell me overall what this album means to you.
Well, this is an album that has grown on me quite alarmingly over the years that I didn't really get at all when I started. Now it is absolutely one of my favourite McCartney albums. In fact, it's one of my favourite albums. It's an outlier. Well, I think it certainly felt like an outlier then, but then I think since Fireman and Twin Freaks and Liverpool Sound Collage, and then that encourages you to look back at Carnival of Lights, not that I've heard that, but you know, and Tomorrow Never Knows and the other things that Paul did, you kind of go, actually maybe this is just as much at the heart of what he does. But I think it's the for me, in a certain way, it's the album where I think you get closest to Paul, to his strangeness, to his daring, to his creative restlessness, and actually his perversity. So I think this is the album that if people were to say that, oh, Paul McCartney, he's very safe, he's very mainstream, he's very predictable, this is the one that I think people should listen to.
Dan Ribalasso, thank you so much.
Thanks, Chris.